This tape is being made on Tuesday at noon, December the 9th. Tuesday noon, December the 9th. This is Channel 2, Side 1. Channel 2, Side 1, on December the 9th, Tuesday, 1969, while we were sitting around the dinner table.
She's a poor, sad snack, but she's no zucchini dog.
And on your opinion of zucchini.
Well, I happen to like zucchini, but Sam, living sausage, don't you want to speak to them a little bit? She was a zucchini dog when she got caught in that wire, though. Yeah, you tell them. Speak a little bit. Tell them.
Come on. Talk to us. Come on. Can't you say something? Come on. Talk to us.
Well, she said her word.
speaking to the ham. Well.
Well, do you need much ironwork for those naval carriages? All I saw was a ring and maybe an axle.
And that's the beauty of them. They don't take much. They have to have cap squares to go over the trunnions, pull the barrel in.
Yeah.
But that's,
I think, the only piece of cast work that they have.
You go looking off over that way. Nobody's going to hear a word you say. They need what?
I'm looking at my diagram over there to see what I'm supposed to what I'm supposed to have on the thing. The cast square is the only part that'll have to be cast, and I'll have to cast some wheels for garrison carriages, because garrison carriages have iron wheels.
Don't they have iron carriages too?
No, that's the funny thing. The garrison. The skeleton carriages that you see in forts and places were peacetime mounts, and they were never used in combat. The soldiers didn't like them because if they got hit by a cannonball, they'd splinter and fly all over the place just like shrapnel.
They, you mean the gun or the soldier gun?
Either one. But if the carriage got hit, it would fragment.
Yeah.
And be dangerous. And also it was impossible to repair. So what they'd do, they'd put the guns on these iron carriages and stick them out in the weather because it wouldn't damage the barrels particularly, and the iron carriages would hold them. But they'd keep a wooden carriage for each iron one. And the wooden carriage would be kept in reserve in case it was needed.
I didn't know that.
No.
But the wooden carriages for fort use, the garrison, had iron wheels, cast iron wheels, to run over the rough stone parapets and things. But ship's guns have wooden wheels, so they won't scar up the decks and raise splinters that the sailors' bare feet would catch in.
Ouch, that hurts. Just the thought of it.
You thought those guys were out there scrubbing that deck with soapstone for fun, didn't you?
I hadn't really thought about why they did it. Hey, you mean sailors go barefoot?
They did in the 19th century. A lot of them still do.
Does Melville tell us that?
I don't know whether Melville says that or not. I expect he takes it for granted. Everybody knows that.
You're running around on those yard arms and so forth, setting the sail.
You've got to be able to grab things with your toes and
swing by them.
But a sailor running across a splintery deck would be an unhappy fellow.
I'd like to see him on that porch. That locust has gotten so it'd go right under a toenail.
The fog is thickening.
What's that, Pam? You got a few more words to say?
Hmm? Well, what you're trying to do now is to get ready to make some patterns. And when you get your patterns made, you'll take them down and have them cast.
That's right.
While all the casting is being done, you can be working on something small iron work and forge stuff
and getting my woodwork patterns out. Mm-hmm. But I've got to, that's what this diagram is that I was working on this morning, is a working diagram so that I can make a pattern in wood on using the lathe and the saws and so forth to make axles. And then I'll take the wood down to Wilkesbarre, I'll leave it with the foundry, and they'll make sand mold from my wooden pattern and cast the axle.
You do have something to say, don't you? You're not a zucchini dog.
Well, you probably wouldn't need more than about, say, a half a dozen of any one part to start off with. Say, six axles for that particular mouth, more or less.
Yeah,
you might as well have six made up as long as they're pouring.
Yeah, well, the way they work, you see, the foundry will take the pattern and they'll make me samples.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the samples that they make me will probably be enough to last me for a while on any given item, any given model.
They keep the molds?
They'll maintain the patterns, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Probably they'd work it either way.
Yeah, if you want to.
I would rather that they keep them if they have a way to keep them without getting them damaged. Because I don't have the storage space. I'm in the same fix that Paul is in that respect. He doesn't have space to store his patterns, so he leaves them with the foundry. But if they'll give me half a dozen of each part, that'll be enough to get me started. Give me, sell me, they won't give me the time of day. But
I just see them. Oh, just go ahead, forget it.
Yeah.
Well, Claude gave you the belt for whatever it was you wanted.
Yeah, but you see, I'm a preferred customer with Claude. And, he tells me all the time that he doesn't have any patience with these people like Woody and John Weaver and all these other characters that come around and want everything for nothing. He says he starts out with a low price and then they want him to go down. Which is true.
So you went in and paid his stated price and he gives you stuff.
I paid his stated price and he gives me bonuses. And I still come out ahead. I haven't been able to complain of anything that I've bought. And if it's not right, I just take it back. Although I haven't had to take anything back.
You know, I may have gotten you the wrong Christmas present.
What was that? How's that?
Well, I was thinking maybe a good heater for that place would have been more useful than this winter than that.
You see, we've got the 220 heater.
Yeah.
And as soon as Wayne puts in the 220 line for me, I can put that one in there in addition to the potbelly stove, and the two working together ought to be able to hold their own against the chill in that place.
Incidentally, that heater, so Wayne told me, will work on three phase. He says it doesn't affect heaters.
Hmm.
You can use three phase current with heaters. It's only motors.
That ice is, I'm sorry to change the subject, but that ice is still sliding off the
limbs?
Yeah, that's one of the things that's got Pam upset. She hears it hit the roof outside.
I'm good. I'm glad. That means it's still melting. And I can get the car out. Or at least turn it around. I don't like to have cars where I can't go anywhere with them.
You sure are bottled up right now.
The way you've got them, the way they're around there now, where you've got the station wagon blocked by the by the little rambler, and you can't get either one of them out.
Right.
Well, it's not digging in, though. I think all you'd have to do to move them is to
throw some
put
nails
some,
or something on there.
Or put some ashes from the fireplace or something.
Well, I believe this is the worst ice storm that they've had up here in at least 10 years.
Well, it hadn't done the damage in the past years that this one has.
Now,
Mary Hamilton said this is the worst one she's seen in a long time.
Well, it breaks my heart to go out there and look down over those pine trees that were blocking our view and see at least a third, maybe half of them, topless. They're just gone. And that means some of them will die all the way back if they're broken back far enough. Of course, we were thinking about thinning them anyway, but I didn't mean for them to be thinned indiscriminately.
It's rather arbitrary.
Well, actually, you see, this doesn't thin them.
Mm.
It just knocks the top out. You've still got the lower parts.
And what I hate worst of all, I think, is losing those two up on the drive. Three.
I think there's three this morning.
Up on the driveway that were part of our ornamental drive, and they would be, as luck would have it, they would be where the singles were instead of where the doubles were.
Yeah.
And some of those that were bent way over haven't come up any. I guess they're still frozen.
They're frozen to the ground. The tops of them are
tied down.
They can't break loose. And when they do, they'll snap back and snap right off.
Maybe not.
Well, you know, pine, it's a funny thing about pine, but...
it gets brittle.
Now, but have you ever noticed that the live wood breaks easier than dead wood?
Oh, yeah, pine gets very, very hard.
That's always amazed me, because I expect old dead wood to be brittle and break and, you know, this sort of thing. But those dead limbs up in the trees will stay up there year after year after year, no matter how much ice forms on them. But
you mean the oaks?
Well, and the pines too.
Oh, yeah.
But the oaks, of course, they stay up there because we can't reach them to get them down. Except one day they're going to come down on our head.
Cheerful thought.
Well, yesterday it was worth your life to walk under any of those trees when those big chunks of ice were coming off, and some of them were, you said?
Big as my fist. Some of them were.
It's amazing to go outside and see a leaf of grass that's about 4 inches long normally, and, you know, just a blade of grass. And there it's sticking up in the air about 6 inches, and it's an inch in diameter, and every blade of grass sticking up like hoarfrost, only bigger. And one single pine needle looked like it was half, 3/4 of an inch thick.
Yeah.
And they must have. How many tons of ice do you suppose we've had out there?
Oh, Lord knows. When you figure one of those small limbs that we lifted off the driveway, how much weight was on it?
And they were just
fragments. They were small, and they were completely covered with the ice. But you figure a long limb with needles on the end of it to catch the ice in each one of those needles building up with ice, and then the branch building up with ice around the circumference. I imagine that they come pretty close to tripling or quadrupling or more in weight.
Well, yesterday afternoon and last night after it had thawed a while and that ice was kept crashing down. And that's when the trees begin to break, is when the ice is melting off of them. Because they snap back, and the snap is what really does the damage. And the ice was coming off in little cylinders like those automatic ice makers make. You know, it's about 6 inches deep all over back there behind the house where the little cylinders of ice have all come down all over the place.
Like somebody emptied the refrigerator.
I hate to drive along the parkway now.
They're going to keep the parkway open this winter.
I know. But I was thinking of what the ice storm did to all the trees along the parkway.
Oh, well, that would be, yeah.
How are they going to keep the parkway open if they decided that the winter
they're
is going to be worth
it? They're going to scrape it. They must have decided.
The State Department's taken over maintenance of it during the winter.
And you see, with all the ski lodges up in this area now, there are enough tourists who would feel that the scenic value would be worth a drive along the parkway. So this will be the first year that they have kept it scraped. Ruth Klein came over yesterday with her eyes big. You know, Ruth, her eyes get so big. And she says, for our first winter up here, you all really had it. What with an earthquake, unprecedented, and now an ice storm that's the worst we've had in years. But we've been lucky. There hadn't been any loss of power. Yanjin's lost their power for about 45 minutes or so.
Some of the guys at work said they lost power.
That was probably down below.
That's okay.
They probably had more moisture than we had up here.
Well, it's funny how spotty. I guess it's the altitude changes that create the spotty weather, but that and the fact that this is the crest of the Blue Ridge and weather on one side is not like weather on the other. But different people who live in different parts of the county have very different stories about what happened the other night.
Now Dave used to say that had to do with the thermal waves that habitually come through certain areas. Some areas are always either warmer or colder than others. And they were talking the other night about the electrical storms and how there are some areas up here that seem to have more electrical storms than other areas. And somebody says because of the iron in the mountains.
Hmm.
And if I were in that Methodist camp, I'd think somebody was trying to tell me something.
They get blown out every year.
It not only lightning not only knocks out their pumps, but it rips the pipes clean out of the ground.
God is speaking to the Methodists. Take that. I don't know, but I do know that Glendale Springs, and when it comes to rain, fog, cold weather, snow, ice, anything like that, Glendale gets the worst of it. And any place that I've driven through on my way to work or to town, and that's over about a distance of 30 miles or so.
Well, how about that strip down by New River, down there where the roadside table is?
Yeah. Well, that's always foggy down there.
Well, they say it's always slick. All those curves down there are always slick, and for you to watch out going to work.
Well, it is true that those those S curves that you hit just before you go down by the river.
And it goes again. The ice is falling.
Well, those things hold ice, and they've got water that washes across them.
Yeah, they come out of the rocks.
It comes out of the rocks, right, out of the cuts there, and it runs across there. And, of course, if it freezes, it produces an instant ice slick.
Well, I've noticed, even other years when we just came up here on weekends, that there are always icicles hanging on those cuts,
mm-hmm.
all from this time of year on regardless of how bright and sunny a day it might be, well, there'll be those frozen cascades down the cuts.
But Glendale Springs, for some reason, gets worse weather than any place else that I know of. I guess we're higher here.
Well, that's true. But sometimes one day when I went into town, we were getting a little snow flurry. And I went into West Jefferson, which is lower. And they had snow. They weren't having flurries. So we were above it that time. Apparently.
Massive cake.
All right.
Yeah, you went to all that trouble to make glaze.
For the cake? Glazed enough.
Glass.
I gotta get some more milk. What's this little piece of cake on the shelf here? It's like it's all lonesome.
It's not ice.
And neglected and forgotten.
I think your bird feeder's cute. Don't you need a little more greenery up the crop?
Well, I thought I'd take some of those little poinsettias and put up there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the
yeah, that'd be all right. It looks a little bare up there after the holly leaves.
You see, I have a tendency to over-decorate, and I don't know but what restraint would be a good word here, because by the time you get suet in those feeders and decorate them with sunflower seeds, it's possible to overdo. They say it's not at Christmas, but I know from experience it is.
Oh, did you get Wayne? Was anybody at the shop?
Nobody there.
He may have been gone to lunch if he was there, but I got a call.
About 2. Usually he's before then.
Yeah. He's probably around fixing water heaters.
Most likely.
I wish Wayne would stir himself up a little more, though, about that. Of course, he can't, or up till now, hadn't been able to get in until we came down about 10 or 10:30, which doesn't give him much time to work before lunch. But it seems to me that he's been awfully slow.
Well, everything is awfully slow.
Well, I just hope he'll let Donald pay him at the same rate he's been working. You see, that way Donald can...
That'd give me about 6 months, wouldn't it?
Please.
What you should have been doing is paying him at the end of each day. He was going home.
No, he'd already be out of money if he'd been doing that.
No, I lost my fork in the shuffle here.
Somebody in the driveway?
Oh boy, Rulane's trying to get in with the oil around your cars that are stalled all over the place in his way. I mean, with the gas.
You might need to move yours, son.
Because I don't want him to go out without giving us the gas.
That great big old truck.
This is Sunday, December, what is it? December 14th, 1969. Jack and I have just returned from church, and the organist was brave and selected an unfamiliar hymn this morning. We were to sing 461. I told Jack I didn't mind if she wanted to change the melody line or the rhythmic line, but when she wanted to change both, it did throw me off. And Jack said that he had sung half of hymn 481 before he realized that we were supposed to be singing 461. Anyway, it was fun. This is Sunday, December 15th, 1969.
How is it that I've seen this print from
Complete Angler?
Complete Angler so many times, but every time I see it, the guy's standing on a different bank of the street.
Maybe it's a different edition. Or maybe they reversed their cut.
Meaning on the right or the left bank, or he's on a different stream?
No. Sometimes he's standing over here on the left bank, putting the fish out of the water, with the town on his left. And sometimes he's standing on the right bank, pulling the fish out of the water, with the town on his right.
Oh, well, they just reversed the cut.
You know, they did that.
How it's supposed to be.
They did that with the Greensburg College annual when they had an aerial picture of the campus, and they used it for the front.
Reversed the negative?
Yeah, they reversed the negative, and everybody was confused about what school they were going to.
Yeah, it was a complete loss.
What was?
The picture. Because you couldn't tell where you were. Couldn't find orientation.
You could hold the book upside down, but that didn't really help either.
You have to hold it up to a mirror.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't take much to make people lose orientation.
No. Not just in pictures. You remember when we first went to Greensboro, and Donald called me from school and said they were closing the school because of the snow. They said snow. Well, I haven't seen snow in Kentucky.
2 inches in Greensboro, they closed
and
the town.
2 inches in Greensboro, they closed the town, and rightly so, because it wasn't snow, and it very rarely is snow in Greensboro. It's plain old sleet, and 2 inches of sleet is different from 2 inches of snow. That's the only accident I ever had. And then remember, I got lost trying to get home?
Mm-hmm.
Because everything looked different. It with the snow on the landscape.
Wind right on the window pane.
You know, we started out this morning to church. The sun was shining brightly, and in the east, there were dark blue clouds over in the west. And every once in a while, it would rain on it, all the way to church. When we got there, we went around to the far side of the church, you know, to go around a little driveway behind it and come up, headed out on the other side. And just as we were swinging around, Father Stenhouse car, he was zooping around, and we almost met right at the end of the church.
I mean,
guess who we ran into on the way to church?
On the way, in back of the church, even.
He'd been into town to meet somebody in the hospital. And I guess he thought he was late or something, because he wasn't there when we turned.
he said he's watched by the clock on the northwestern bank.
Oh no.
Only the clock on the northwestern bank has been stopped for years. He said, but you know, the funny thing about it was he was right. His watch was right when he got to church.
Hmm.
Just coincidence, I guess.
Divine providence.
Yeah.
He had another one of his sons there. That's
was
the third
that his
one.
Son?
I think so.
That didn't look like either one of his other boys.
Yes, it did.
No, it looked
take
like
that.
Yeah, they only have two sons.
I thought they had three.
You did?
Yeah. They have three.
Well, this one looked more like he belonged to Reverend Rudolph. You know, they did. And yet Rudolph doesn't have but just one child.
And the Hermans were there, or he was.
About 15 of his children were there.
Took up two pews. And that doesn't count the ones that are away at college.
I bet he gets his telephone calls free, though.
To all those kids away from home.
I bet he doesn't. You might get them free as far as the local exchange is concerned, but yeah, man.
Where is it you're going, Donald?
Lansing moves?
Yeah.
Over to Lansing. See this gum collector over there. Supposed to have a fabulous collection. Also know everybody around that knows anything about guns.
Well, I think you need a little trip or visit or something to give you a break. Spend all your time either at Industrial Plastics or in the barn.
They don't call it a barn anymore. The Millers started calling it the shop, but there's some other people around here now who refer to it as the factory.
That's Mark.
Oh, is that Mark?
Mark Miller. Well, if they drop around today, or tomorrow, it would look a little more like a ordnance works that Star Movies counted in.
Now, is this collector, maybe they tell us about him after, but is Kyle a gun collector? I mean, is he interested in guns?
Sort of, secondarily. Kyle, you know, is a mountain craftsman.
Oh.
First water. And he has his own little shop over. I saw it yesterday.
Craftsman?
Mm-hmm. He does all kinds of little things. In wood, especially. And, also works some in iron.
Large things? Or do you mean like?
Well, he carves in wood. And he's done a lot of little figurines and models. He's got a model of a covered wagon with the wagon and the team of two oxen that he carved. And he has one that I would, or a couple of pieces that I would love to have. And carvings of a looks like a razorback hog, an old rough boar hog. But the way it's shaped, its back is arched, you know, it's got its bristles up, and the arch of its back goes up, and then it comes down the front, and the snout picks up the same curve in reverse in the front.
Oh.
So that it's kind of an S-shaped curve line to the back.
Well, now, is he a trained artist, or
pretty much self-taught.
But he does, like the doll maker, so carving beautiful work.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was one of the things that impressed me about this boar hog that he carved. It's not just the shape of the object, but he's used the grain of the wood, which is a kind of curly maple, so that the grain looks like the fur. On the hog.
I'd like to see that.
It's gorgeous. He's got two of them. He did one in walnut and one in maple. And he's got them sitting on a pylon or a pedestal about a foot high, which is also carved out of the same wood.
Does he have a whole slew of special tools like you have, or does he?
I think he does most of his carving with a pocket knife. He has a small wood lathe and a good set of turning knives. And he's got he showed me yesterday a jigsaw that he made out of a Singer sewing machine. He took an old one of these old pedal type sewing machines, put a motor on it, went inside and took out all the guts that didn't do anything except the ones that ran the needle.
The needle up and down.
And stripped it and blocked it up so he had about 2 inches of space between the floor plate and the top the bottom stroke of the needle. And in place of the needle, he put in one of these 2-4-nickel blades, saw blades, coffee saw blades, and ran it down under the floor plate and put a spring underneath it to hold the tension on it.
Yeah.
So that on the upstroke, it's pulling against the spring, and on the downstroke, the spring pulls with it.
Yeah, that's pretty clever.
And, oh my goodness, that thing just goes to town. He hits the switch on that thing, and he can take a piece of 1/4-inch plywood and rip through that and just cut all kinds of jigsaw puzzles out of it. Got any shape, you know, go around in circles and do loops and curves and swirls.
I guess so. Old sewing machines would be treasures like all the other old junk that people rescue and modify around here.
Oh yeah, he's got a collection of it. He's kind of an antique collector too. He's got an ox yoke that belonged to his grandfather, and it's a real one. You know, it's not something that somebody's made up to sell in the trading post. Something like that. But it's still, you can see where the oxen have worn it. The backs have rubbed the wood away. And it's got all kinds of stuff like that. A butter churn, an old butter churn with a geared crank and paddles.
Well, that's newfangled.
The newfangled invention about 1870, I guess. And he's going in for doing a little rifle building now.
Doesn't he have to have a license? No, up here doesn't that matter?
Not for antiques. No. So he's building a muzzleloader. Mm. And he was talking with me about it, asking my advice on what kind of block work to put in it and where to get the best stock blanks and things. I think he's going to order his stuff from Dixie in Tennessee. And get into the long rifle building business.
Well, now, isn't that going to compete a little bit with this old fella out here on the, what's that road out that way?
Beaver Creek. Because I don't think Kyle is really planning to sell his work. I think he's just building for his own enjoyment.
Well, you know, he was over here one afternoon.
But, see, the market can absorb a whole lot of rifles. There's no trouble there. If he wanted to go into the business, there are not enough craftsmen to supply the trade now. And most of the really fine gun work like that on these old muzzleloaders just isn't being done and can't be done by mass production methods. You can't do the kind of carving and inlay work that goes into one of those things with a machine.
Well, how do they get around? They call those antiques, the muzzleloaders. But how do they get around the gun laws, especially as touchy as the country is now about gun laws, on what constitutes a weapon and what, Barney wrote you and said, now, when that newspaper man comes to interview you, for God's sake, don't say weapon. But how do you draw the line between what it constitutes a weapon and what, these guns will kill you just as dead as a modern one, won't they?
Yeah, but the whole rationale of the laws, at least supposedly, at least the ones that they've enacted so far, the theory behind it has been that it's supposed to control crime. And therefore, the guns that they've been legislating against, or the sales practices that they've been legislating against, are those which would tend to put guns which would be likely to be used in a crime in the hands of the general populace.
Yeah. Well, naturally, a man who's thinking, or even one who's, thinking of either a crime or self-protection, would be more apt to buy a handgun, a pistol or something like that, and a revolver. He'd want something modern rather than something that he'd have to stop and drop in a ball.
I don't suppose that the police records show many murders committed by muzzle loaders.
Not since the turn of the century, I expect.
And I doubt that the Black Panthers or the Mafia include muzzle loaders in their armories.
Well, it seems highly unlikely, and at least the government, people in the legislative branch have been inclined to view it this way. I don't know of anybody who would be out to stick up a bank with a muzzle-loading long rifle. It's just a little bit unwieldy for the job, and certainly muzzle-loading cannons are never likely to be classed as concealable weapons.
No, hardly. Not the way you have to drag them on. But just talking to people who know nothing, who are completely out of touch with this antique gun thing. You say that a person belongs to an organization like the Kentucky Long Gun, what is the name of that organization?
I forget.
But anyway, these various shooting clubs have a reputation of being a front for the Klan, or in the South, frequently for the Klan or the Citizens Committee, or whatever they call the citizens. What do they call them?
White citizens.
And they're beginning to this reputation is beginning to color even the muzzle loading clubs. In the public mind,
Well, the Klan does organize itself sometimes around shooting clubs.
And I suppose the Birch, John Birch chapters do too, some of them. But usually they are skeet shooters or they shoot modern weapons.
I know that, but in the public mind, the distinction is not being made.
Well, public mind doesn't make many distinctions of any sort.
Okay. Excuse me.
I don't know. I know that there are certainly a lot of very, very conservative people who are inclined to black powder sports and are engaged in muzzle-loading shooting, but I don't think that there's any of the muzzle-loading clubs are serving as political or social fronts for conservative organizations or ultra-right-wingists or ultra-left-wingists or anything else. It just doesn't go that way. The people who are involved in the black powder clubs are usually people of a strongly historical turn of mind or historical interests, and who are interested in not only just black powder shooting, but in recovering a lot of the skills and the life styles and patterns and the flavor of 18th, 19th century in America.
Oh, that reminds me, you know, Kyle came over here one day to look at your account, and he came in the house for a few minutes and forgotten what the conversation was, but he had the awe in his voice when he spoke of his admiration of people who could do things with their hands and had pride in workmanship was something. Now you talk about something I'd like to get on tape. I'd like to have, if I could just catch that again, because he was so he admired anybody who took a great deal of pride in doing something with their hands and doing it well. Of course, he was intending it as a compliment to you, but he was talking about his table he had made too. And I'd like to get over and see it.
You should. It's very nice.
And the skunk, too.
And the skunk. Don't miss the skunk. Yeah.
I'm afraid that I don't want to go near that skunk. I don't care if you... He hasn't been de-skunked.
He hasn't been de-skunked, no. But I'm surprised at how friendly and domesticable the skunks are. Because I've never seen one really irritated, and I expect you would have to really rile one up. Make him think that you were really endangering him before he would become violent.
He knows his power.
He knows where he stands. He's not. He doesn't have to show off, you know. this skunk of Kyle's. I was ready to run last night because Kyle has him in a cage that he's made out of a 50-gallon oil drum or something, and he's cut one side of it out and put screen in, you know.
Yeah.
And the skunk has a little hay nest in there, and it's a big skunk too. It's not a little bitty skunk. It's a big skunk.
Is it the bishop skunk?
It's a bishop with
white,
a little white
hair.
Cap. Yeah.
Yeah, white.
And which seems to be the most prevalent around here. I haven't seen many of the others. And it was in its nest in there, and Kyle had found a rabbit on the road that a car had hit, and skunks would eat anything, so he threw the rabbit in there for the skunk, and the skunk had started to work on it and had eaten about half of the rabbit. And so Kyle said, "Come on, I want to show you my skunk." And we went over there, and the skunk was sitting there gnawing on its rabbit, and Kyle reached in and petted the skunk, and the skunk came up and nuzzled around and real friendly, and then And Kyle said, let's see what you're doing to the rabbit. And he reached in and got the rabbit and started to pull it out. And the skunk didn't appreciate that. He was taking his meal away. So Kyle had one end of the rabbit dragging it out, and the skunk grabbed the other end and dragged it back. And they were tug of war right there. I said, for God's sake, let him have it.
Was the cage still out to the, by the
barn, but it's on the other side.
I'm surprised Pam hasn't gone up there.
Well, she may have.
Well, she hadn't come back smelling like she's been up there.
Well, she probably didn't investigate too closely.
And she,
I doubt it.
The way she chases those kitty cats, why do you think that, look at her ears, they went up, she knows those words.
Said a word, didn't she? Yeah.
Well, it's up pretty high off the ground.
She may not even have noticed it. Skunks don't have much odor unless they want to. She might not have even noticed it was there.
Did he have a name for it?
Not that I know of.
He just called it Sweet Pea or something.
What was that horrible pun you made last night about books?
I just said that since we've been spending so much time on the tapes, that we've changed from being bookworms to being tapeworms.
That was it. I wish I had
known. You wanted me to repeat it.
We've been talking about the reaction of the average John citizen to hearing that somebody is marketing cannons. Makes me think of what Wayne said the first time I met him. I was still working over at Fred's.
But there's another picture.
And I had asked Fred to get in touch with him, or I'd called him, I forget which, to see about wiring the shop. And when he came over and heard what I was going to do, he didn't know quite what to think. He said, here they're passing laws in Congress and make it so you can't even buy a box of 22 cartridges across the counter without giving your name and driver's license and fingerprints and Lord knows what all. And here you're out selling something that a man can take and blow the side off a mountain with.
That's the reason Delmer, we couldn't get... I think that's the reason Delmer was reluctant to allow you to use his building. It would have been, as you said, a better location, but when you said Kenham, that scared Delmer and all the community scared us clean off. Fred was the only one that had the courage to say, come on, let's do it. And really, I think who helped you with Fred about that was Tom. Tom with his dreams and his visions. He believes in it. He believes in you and your... I don't mean that Tom's impractical. He just can see things that some other people can't.
I think Delmer now is wishing...
Delmer's dying of jealousy now.
Yeah,
he's just curling. And Bear, the Bears up there...
They
changed their minds in a hurry when you really started to get going with... They said, wish I'd known he'd wanted those. I have two nice rooms down there he could have had. And all of them are they're just a wee bit jealous of Fred and his acquisition.
Bill Kretz was moaning and groaning because he said, here I was trying to get out of the butchering business, and I've got this nice...
Abattoir,
excuse me. Closing down his abattoir. And he said, I could have sold him that building, and it had been just what he wanted. Concrete floors, wiring already in, loading platforms, office. It had been perfect for him. I said, how much do you want for it? $8,000. And that includes 2 acres of land. I said, well, even if Don had, that had been perfect for Don, he couldn't have afforded $8,000. Bill said, oh, yes, he could, the way I'd have him pay it.
I thought he said $6,000.
No, it was $8,000.
Even it still would have been a good buy if we'd known about it soon enough and if we had the money.
I could have taken out a GI loan or something.
Oh, yeah, you could have done that. But
it's funny, you know, how things go. You can't just go in and say, well, I'm going to do something. Rent me space or sell me this or do that and do the other. People aren't impressed. And once you start moving and really get something done or look like you're going to get something done, then everybody comes flocking in and says, oh, can we help you with this? Can we help you with that? And by that time, it's too late, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, Fred was pretty foxy about that. What was it, a harvester or something that...
Threshing machine.
And the day before, Donald had said, you know that old threshing machine that they've thrown over there against the thing? If I had the money, I'd buy it, because it has enough gears and wheels and stuff, and I could use it. And I said, don't you worry. Fred will buy it, and he'll sell it to you, piece by piece. And sure enough, within 24 hours, there it came down the highway. And Fred hauled it up on his by his garage up there. Came over and said, Don, I've got some gears and wheels for you.
And I had never talked to him about it. He just knew me.
Well, he's been going around showing you his treasure troves recently, hasn't he?
Yeah. He took me up behind the barn the other day and said, now, I'll show you something up here and be useful for you. And there it is. I looked and there was nothing but some grass growing there. I said, well, that's pretty grass. Well, what else, you know? He said, well, there's $60 of sand under that grass. He said, I had a load dumped up here a while back and it's growed over. If you ever need any sand to mix cement with or anything, there it is. Just dig it out.
Oh, I didn't tell you, you know, Fred's the one who said he's never gotten skinned. And Thursday I went in to do our usual shopping at West Jefferson, and I stopped in at Jefferson Drugstore. And Ruth Shepherd introduced me to the pharmacist, and he said that he had been down to eat your factory, and that he was Fred's nephew or something. Well, Fred was his uncle, I guess, but he said. And he said, don't mention my name to him, though.
To Fred?
Yeah. He said, don't mention my name to him. So I looked a little curious, and he went on. He said that Fred had a washstand, you know, one of these old antique washstands that you put that holds the basin and the pitcher and stuff. And this fellow's name is Sheets, so there's some of the Sheets that are related to him.
Oh, evidently.
And Fred had the washstand, and Jim Sheets and his wife wanted it. And they went in to see Fred about it, and Fred said he wanted $15 for it. Jim said he jumped up and down, and he said he wouldn't pay more than $5 for that. Well, they haggled and went on for days, and finally Fred came down on the price. And he says, Jim said, don't ever let him tell you he's never gotten skinned, because I sure skinned him. And he took the stand and had it refinished and said it's a beautiful piece of furniture. And then I almost let the cat out of the bag that I want that desk that's up there in the barn is lost. But I didn't. I cut myself off right in the middle of the sentence. I think. But you need another one.
I know the one with all the gingerbread all over it and everything.
Yeah, that old Victorian thing.
Looks like Pennsylvania Dutch or something.
That's
got all the.
That could be a beautiful piece of furniture. And I think Fred knows it. I think that's the reason he has it hidden under the hay.
I don't know. He says it belongs to some guy down in Florida.
Really?
I don't know whether it's still under or not. He's got another desk in his woodshed that's a handmade job out of curly maple. And that's a beautiful thing.
I haven't seen that.
It's plain. It's not.
Well, I would like a plainer one better than I do all that gingerbread.
What kind
what
is it?
It's a writing desk.
Oh.
That with a fold up flat top that folds down to make a writing surface.
Oh, yeah.
And it has pigeonholes and things like that. And drawers.
Don, you never did see that Wells Fargo safe, did you, the antique store in Greensboro? There are only about 20 of them in the country. That's the most amazing antique I think I've ever seen. Great, big, heavy thing. But the Wells Fargo people, you know, used to deliver the mail as well as the money. And it has all the little, one side has a slot for dropping the mail in. And, you know, the two doors that open in the front. One side has a slot for dropping the mail in, and the other side has little pigeonholes where they sorted the mail. And then back in the back, there's a lock-type safe inside these big, heavy doors, beside these big, heavy doors, for the gold or whatever else they might have been carrying. This was really one of the original Wells Fargo safes.
Mm.
It's a beautiful thing. Man wanted to sell it to me, and I told him we couldn't afford it. And the next time I went out, it was gone. Somebody had bought it.
Somebody, well, I bet he wanted plenty for it, too.
I think about $600.
Hmm.
Wasn't as bad as...
That's not as bad as I would have thought.
I thought he would have wanted.
It's more than I could afford, though.
This is the end of Channel 2, Side 1. Sunday, December the 14th at lunchtime. This is the end of Channel 2, Side 1, Sunday, December the 14th at lunchtime.